saved. وإن أمتي ستفرق بعدي على 73 فرقة. And my nation would be divided after me into 73 sects. فرقة منها ناجية. So فرقة ناجية is mentioned in this version. Only one of them is saved. واثنتان وسبعون في النار. And 72 sects would be in the hellfire. So this is حديث الافتراق. Hadith of division. This is the famous hadith of Hadith al-Iftiraq, Hadith of Division, referring to different divisions among the Jews, among the Christians, and among Muslims, and according to some narrations, among Majus as well. And now, the question is that, and this is mentioned, as I mentioned, by many Shia and Sunni scholars in their books, because at the end of the day, the Holy Prophet is referring to many divisions among Muslims, many denominations and sects, and the fact that only one of them is saved, and one of them is going to reach salvation. There are many discussions about the authenticity of this hadith, for example, because it's not mentioned in Sahih Muslim and Sahih Bukhari and Nawbakhti in Firaq al-Shi'a and Abu al-Hasan Ash'ari in Maqalat al-Islamiyin. These two books are about the Islamic sects. They have not referred to this hadith.
Yes.
According to Ibn Hazm and Durusi, this is not an authentic narration.
Mm-hmm.
But as I mentioned, at least this is a very well-known narration. And some people believe that it is not only a famous narration, mashhur, but also a mutawatir, widely transmitted by the Shia and Sunni scholars. And one of the contemporary scholars, Ayatollah Subhani, believes that although the chain of the narration might not be that authentic, but because of the fact that it's been quoted by many scholars in different books, through different chains, we can make sure that this is an authentic narration. But again, as I mentioned, this is a difference of there is a difference of ideas among both Shia and Sunni scholars whether this is an authentic narration or not.
IRIB English Radio presents questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Are there any indications, for example, in Khutbah Qadiriyah, referring to, for example, selecting Imam Ali alayhi salam as the successor and then referring, for example, refer to him, or you will be divided if you do not believe in him as the authentic successor of me?
Okay, now the main question here is that, okay, let's imagine that we have accepted this narration of Hadith al-Iftiraq. So which firqa, which denomination is the al-firqatun najiyah, the saved sect? So it's very natural that all the Muslim scholars who have accepted this narration, they have claimed that the firqatun najiyah is referring to what I'm following. So if you're Sunni, if you're Ash'ari, Mu'tazili, because again, we need to find all these 73 sects. The Holy Prophet, according to this narration, is telling us that the Islamic nation would be divided into 73 sects.
Yes.
And some scholars, some Muslim scholars, have tried to number these 73 sects because it's not easy.
Okay.
Whether it is theological denominations or, I mean, the different schools in jurisprudence, but some have tried to do so. But then the question is that, okay, which one is the saved sect?
Or maybe the number is showing kasra, the multitude, for example, of going astray to this and that, isn't
it? It's very unlikely, because the Holy Prophet, when he is comparing Jews, Christians, Muslims, when he says that Jews were divided into 71, Christians into 72, and Muslims into 73, it's very unlikely to refer to I mean, not
so the number is authentic,
number.
You mean?
It's mean okay. It seems that the wordings of the narration is telling us that 73 matters. It's mm-hmm. not only referring to the great number of the sects and denominations. So again, as I mentioned, it's very natural that when it comes to Sunni, they have claimed that this Firqatun Najiyah, this sect, is referring to Ahlus Sunnah. Again, we have many divisions among Sunnis when it comes to theology. We have Ash'aris, Mu'tazilis, Maturidis, New Ash'aris, New Mu'tazilis. Yes. When it comes to jurisprudence, we have Maliki, Shafi'i, mm-hmm. Hanbali, Hanafi, and all these divisions among the Sunnis. When it comes to Shia, again, we have like Zaydis, Ismailis, Waqifis, Twelvers. So it's very natural and normal to claim that, I mean, each scholar who belongs to a sect to claim that yes. We are the saved sect.
Okay.
But there is, I believe that there is only one point which is only specific for the Shia, for the Twelver Shias. And this is the fact that the Twelvers Shia are the only Islamic sect that can prove their beliefs based on the sources of other Islamic denominations. So, for example, you cannot find any Sunni scholar who can believe the authenticity of Sunni school of thought based on Shia sources. But as Twelvers, we are able to prove the authenticity of the Shia school of thought based on Sunni sources. For example, when it comes to appointing Imam Ali alayhi salam as the first successor after the Holy Prophet, there are many narrations in this regard in Sunni sources.
Yes.
Beginning from Hadith Yawm al-Indar, the day that the Holy Prophet invited his close relative to the religion of Islam, and he introduced Imam Ali alayhi salam as his caliph and vizier. The famous narration of Manzala before the Battle of Tabuk, in which the Holy Prophet told Imam Ali alayhi salam that you are like Aaron to Moses,
yes.
to me, except that there is no prophet after me. Hadith of Ghadir, which has been mentioned in many sources of Ahlus Sunnah. So this is one point that is very clear in Sunni sources. When it comes to the purity of Imam Ali alayhi salam and Ahlul Bayt,
Ayatul Tathir, Ayatul Ikmar,
and the narrations which are mentioned in Sunni sources about the fact that Ayatul Tathir was revealed about Lady Zahra salamullah alayha, mm-hmm. Imam Ali alayhi salam, and Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhim as-salam. When it comes to Hadith of Thaqalain, it's a mutawatir narration in Sunni sources. The Holy Prophet is telling the Muslims that I'm leaving among you the Quran and my Ahlul Bayt. And yes. Ahlul Bayt, according to Sunni sources, are referring to the Imams and Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha. The narration that reads that if you die without knowing the Imam of your time, yes. your death is the death of ignorance. So the question is that who is the Imam of our time? Mm-hmm. It is only the Shia who believes in an alive Imam right now and in all the times, from the time of the Prophet onwards.
Yes.
Or even more importantly, the famous narration of 12 caliphs. It's been mentioned in many Sunni sources with authentic chains of the narration yes. that the Holy Prophet said, after me there would be 12 caliphs or 12 emirs, or 12 rulers, and through them Islam would be...
Even sometimes say the names were mentioned.
Yeah,
that's another hadith.
Another narration, yes, yes. yeah. But the narration of 12 caliphs, in that yes. there is no name.
Yes.
But Sunni scholars, they have discussed what this number of 12 is referring to, and none of them has been able to bring a convincing answer to the mm-hmm. question is that what this number is referring to.
Okay.
And only the Shia are able to explain this narration. So my point is that although it's very natural to the followers of all Islamic denominations to claim that this Firqatun Najiyah is referring to the sect that they follow,
yes.
but it seems that Shia, the Twelver Shia, are the only denominations that can prove that they are the saved sect based on the sources of other mm-hmm. denominations.
Okay.
Just let me share one last point regarding this hadith of Iftiraq.
Yes.
Some books have been written about this narration.
Yes.
And specifically by, I'm talking about the books written by the Shia scholars. Among them are As-Sawarim al-Madiya fil Firqat al-Najiya, written by Sayyid Muhammad Mahdi Husseini Qazwini al-Hilli. He tries to prove that this narration is referring, Al-Firqat al-Najiya is referring to the 12 Shia.
Yes.
Allama Majlisi admires this book a lot. Ithbat al-Firqat al-Najiya by Muhammad Hassan Shariat Madar Astarabadi, who passed away in 1318. In it, not only he proves that Al-Firqat al-Najiya is referring to the 12 Shia, he also mentioned the names of the remaining 72 sects. And also Al-Firqat al-Najiya by Ibrahim bin Sulaiman Qatifi.
Yes.
Risalat al-Usuliyya fi Ithbat al-Madhab al-Firqat al-Najiya min Bain al-Firq al-Islamiyya by Sheikh Ja'far Kashif al-Ghita. And Ithbat al-Firqat al-Najiya by Khaja Nasiruddin al-Tusi.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of Al-Firqat al-Najiya or the saved sect. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
Inna fi al-jannati nahran min labani Ali. حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي حسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي تهران
روباشافت غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The organizers said it was going to be big, and they were right. Hundreds of thousands of people showing solidarity with Palestine and united in one thing.
A ceasefire. Stop the genocide, because that's what's happening. We can all see it.
We need to speak up. The world needs to wake up and speak up. This is not okay. This is genocide, and not in our name. That's why we're here today. Not in our name.
It's the biggest march since the Israeli onslaught on Gaza commenced, with hundreds of thousands of people walking hours to the American Embassy in London to condemn U.S. support for the Israeli regime. The protest was organized by Palestinian support groups, Muslim organizations, and peace movements. People of all faiths and no faith, some all the way from Northern Ireland, angry with decades of Israel's brutal military occupation in the occupied territories. Anger at the British government, too, for cracking down on these demonstrations, describing them as hate marches and pro-Palestine mobs.
In the run-up to today's march, the UK's right-wing interior minister, Suella Braverman, tried to get the police to cancel it because it coincides with Armistice Day, commemorating the end of the First World War, a move campaigners and organizers have described as a crackdown on freedom of speech.
Previously, she asked police to make a call on whether even waving a Palestinian flag constituted a racially aggravated offense. Today, as in previous rallies, a forest of Palestinian flags. More than anything, today's march, which harks back to the mass demonstration before the 2003 U.S.-led illegal invasion of Iraq, is aimed at pushing the British state which during the First World War publicly promised a national home for the Jewish people in its controversial 1917 Balfour Declaration, to pressure Israel to cease its brutal shelling of Gaza. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The Supreme Follow-up Committee of the Palestinian Revolutionary Factions organized a major protest in Yarmouk camp on Friday to support the resistance and condemn the massacre committed by the Israeli regime against defenseless civilians in Gaza.
We assure our people in Gaza that we stand with them resiliently, sharing their wounds and pain. We tell the occupying entity that we will liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque and meet our people in Palestine. We pledge to the resistance front to pray in Al-Quds.
The defeated Israeli occupation is taking revenge by killing children and women and historically destroying humanity.
We, the Islamic Jihad Al-Quds Brigades abroad, vote to enter Palestine and liberate it, as we promise to eliminate Israel.
With unbridled fury, demonstrators burned the Israeli flag, confirming that the Resilient Resistance Front has proven that American threats no longer intimidate anyone, and vowed to defend Palestine with their lives until liberation.
As the Palestinian resistance and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah have stated, let America come. So we will fight our main and fundamental enemy. We are not afraid of America's intimidations, as it is more cowardly than waging a war.
We call on everyone and every country capable of doing anything to imagine their children thirsty, dismembered, lying in a hospital or buried under rubble.
Protesters called on international community to assume its human responsibility by ending the brutal Israeli aggression on Gaza and lifting the siege imposed on its people.
Syrians and Palestinians gathered today to tell the world that Palestine is a beacon that will never fade, and the people of Gaza will never capitulate despite the tremendous Western support for the Israeli atrocities committed against them. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Crowds of Yemenis took to the streets of the capital Sana'a after Friday prayers to reaffirm their solidarity with Palestinians and to condemn the brutal Israeli aggression on besieged Gaza Strip. Israel's bombardment of Gaza, which started over a month ago, has claimed the lives of more than 11,000 Palestinians, most of whom women and children.
We came out today to express our support for the Palestinian resistance fighters and to show our solidarity with Palestinian civilians who are being killed by all types of Israeli weapons.
My message to the Arab leaders who have normalized ties with Israel: you will suffer great consequences from your people and from the entire Muslim world.
The participants in the Friday demonstration also expressed their support for the Yemeni army's latest missile and drone attacks, which targeted the city of Eilat in the south of occupied Palestine and forced Israeli schools to close temporarily.
We indeed fired our cruise and ballistic missiles at Tel Aviv and Eilat, and they reached their targets. We also shot down a U.S. spy drone over Yemen's territorial waters. The Americans initially denied this, but we proved that to the world and released that video, which forced them to later admit the truth.
The speeches delivered at the rally stressed that it is a religious duty for Yemen's armed forces to continue targeting the Israeli entity despite any consequences Yemen may face. As long as Yemen defies U.S. and continues to launch attacks against Israel, there is a high possibility that Yemen could soon be targeted by Israeli and American fighter jets. But according to Abdelmalek al-Houthi, the leader of Yemen's revolution movement, Yemen will be ready at the time. As the Yemeni military spokesperson has confirmed, Yemen will continue to launch drone and ballistic missiles towards Israel until a ceasefire is reached. The Yemeni army is also considering targeting Western military warships that are currently patrolling in the Red Sea. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
In South Korea, rallies and marches in support of Palestine have added pressure to the U.S. to get Israel to end its military campaign in Gaza. But U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Japan and South Korea this week repeated remarks that contradict the realities of Israel's military bombardment and invasion of Gaza.
It is imperative that the Palestinian people be central to governance in Gaza and in the West Bank as well, and that, again, we don't see a reoccupation. And what I've heard from Israeli leaders is that they have no intent to reoccupy Gaza and retake control of Gaza.
Unlike the U.S., South Korea has not offered unconditional support for Israel as it seeks to maintain good relations and trade with its many Middle Eastern partners. Activists argue leaders must do more to rein in Israel's attack on Gaza.
How you can let this happen? Where is your dignity? Where is your honor? Where is you stand for the rights? I'm not standing for the religion. What's happening in Palestine is not about religion. It's not about Islam. They bomb churches, they bomb mosques, they kill babies, Muslims, Christians. No matter what religion, they just kill. And this is exactly what is the definition of terrorism.
Social media has been instrumental in spreading awareness of the disproportionate Israeli attacks. At each demonstration in Seoul, local Korean activists and supporters of Palestine join residents from all over the world, the U.S., the Middle East, and elsewhere, as the voices demanding a ceasefire grow.
As criticism is heaped on the U.S. over its blanket support of Israel, American officials say they're trying to encourage Tel Aviv to limit civilian casualties. Meanwhile, the Biden administration seeks a further $14 billion in military aid for Tel Aviv that many suggest might be used for more Israeli war crimes. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The Iranian embassy in Damascus organized a consultative meeting entitled Israel on the Slope of Fall to discuss the most important repercussions of the Hamas-led Al-Aqsa Float operation against Israel. The Iranian ambassador has expressed his absolute confidence in the victory of the resistance.
The Zionist entity in America were defeated by the resistance in Syria, especially that more than 80 countries got involved and failed. Likewise, the entire Western world waged a battle against Yemen and failed. Victory today is in the hands of the resistance axis.
The Palestinian resistance has proven that it is capable of facing challenges. The Al-Aqsa flood operation is considered a tsunami in military thinking, a marvel in field performance, and a fundamental foundation upon which much can be built in a scientific, objective, and logical manner.
Analysts and experts confirm that the Al-Aqsa flood operation is a historic military epic that imposed a new reality on the Israeli entity and will lead to its demise and the expulsion of the American forces from the region.
As leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, the pure blood of martyr Qasem Soleimani demands the complete expulsion of the Americans from the region.
No regional and Arab country will be able to pressure the resistance to release the prisoners without paying the price.
Participants emphasized the importance of preserving the outcomes of this achievement and consecrating it as a significant victory that signifies a new milestone in the course of the conflict. Despite any debates over what happened on October the 7th, everyone agrees that Palestinian resistance has destroyed the myth of the invincible Israeli army and that Al-Aqsa Flood operation has initiated the countdown to the end of Israel. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
The Israeli onslaught in Gaza has ignited a wave of protests across Pakistan as people express their anger over the regime's back-to-back attacks on the besieged territory.
Israel would never be able to carry out its inhumanity and its barbarity and its atrocities unless it was helped and funded and supported and weaponized by America, UK, European Union, and I want to condemn the Organization of Islamic Conference for being complicit and silent and inactive.
In response to the ongoing crisis in Gaza, Pakistani citizens are raising their voices to demand an end to the war crimes being committed in the region.
So far, no financial support, no medical support, and no practical food and other necessities have been delivered to the people of Gaza. So there is a catastrophe, there is a humanitarian crisis, war crimes are being committed by Israel.
The Gaza is bleeding and Gaza is being massacred in huge numbers, and we are unable to do anything. We are not even able to give the aid to them, to provide medicine, to provide food, commodities, how they are living in the open sky. And the children are bleeding, children are dying every day.
Meanwhile, the government of Pakistan is responding to the ongoing Israeli aggression by sending its second consignment of relief goods that consisted of hygiene kits, medicines and food packages.
Like people in many parts of the world, Pakistanis are worried about Israel's constant air attacks on civilians in Gaza. They demand an immediate end to the regime's onslaught. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
As part of a diplomatic dash across West Asia, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Ankara and met with his Turkish counterpart Hakan Fidan. The visit comes one day ahead of the Turkish police raiding pro-Palestinian protesters who tried entering the Incirlik airbase, which hosts U.S. troops with tear gas and water cannons. Demonstrators condemned the U.S. unconditional support for Israel in its aggression against Palestinians, stressing the U.S. is Israel's partner in the genocide taking place in Gaza.
The fierce Israeli attacks against Palestinians are due to the United States' unlimited support to Netanyahu's cabinet. If the U.S. did not support Israel from the first place, we wouldn't see them committing such massacres openly and not even thinking of the consequences. I think the only way a ceasefire or pause can be achieved if the U.S. stops its blind support to the Israeli government in its aggression on Gaza. The United States must use its influence to push for peace, not war. And the huge rallies we've seen in the U.S. and the American public refusing to fund massacres and genocides will push the Biden administration to stop its support to Israel.
In a speech made during his visit to his hometown, Rize, the Turkish president said his country has never left the brothers in Gaza unprotected, helpless and alone, and will never do so. Erdogan said that it is Turkey's duty to protect the holy sites in Jerusalem al-Quds. He added that Israel has taken a very wrongful step by which it has darkened its future.
It is our duty to save our Palestinian brothers from Israeli oppression and to stop the massacres committed in Gaza before the eyes of the world.
Turkey has been strongly condemning Israeli aggression on Gaza, which has killed more than 10,000 Palestinians, most of them women and children. Ankara has withdrawn its ambassador in Israel and strongly condemned the Israeli aggression on Gaza. The country's President Erdogan has also threatened to call Israel a war criminal. But there has still been no clear and official statement on cutting ties with the occupying regime. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
On Monday, a conference called Religions on Peace and War was held at Rome's Luis Guido Carli University, considered one of the most distinguished private research institutes in Italy. The conference, attended by academics and representatives of religious groups, had been presented as an initiative on the positive role religions can play in peacemaking or de-escalating violent conflicts. It turned out to be a meeting absurdly victimizing Israel in the ongoing siege launched on the Gaza Strip without any regard for the massacre of innocent people who have been under oppression and occupation for decades in Palestine. In addition to that, a number of deceitful statements were presented by some of the conference speakers to the audience.
What I'm saying here is that terrorists used violence on Israeli people on October 7, going to their homes and chopping the heads off kids and killing women after abusing them. Saying that Israel upholds the Palestinians in a state of apartheid is out of context. What's happening in former Palestine is Palestinians' responsibility.
UN experts and a number of human rights organizations, including Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, have argued for years that apartheid is being practiced by Israel in the occupied Palestinian territories. One of the speakers and some students from the audience pointed out that the reconstruction of the events occurred in Palestine made by the president of the Jewish community was totally biased.
The role of religions is also to promote dialogue in order to find solutions. The issue here is that mutual recognition must be the starting point. The previous speaker called the disputed territories former Palestine. How can you call them that way? There is no former Palestine. There is Palestine and there are Palestinians. We won't go anywhere if we continue this way.
At no time during the conference, it was mentioned that over 10,000 Palestinian civilians and more than 4,000 children have been slaughtered so far after 4 weeks of Israeli bombardment on the besieged Gaza Strip. One of the issues that have been raised during the conference is how Western countries are showcasing a very selective morality in choosing the conflicts where they express outrage and claiming their universal values. In the same way, for decades, the West has had a selective and biased approach to the implementation of international law. Max Civili, Rome.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Fueled by demands from the Zionist lobby groups, U.S. students who are organizing against Israel's genocidal attacks are facing accelerated repression by their own university administrations. These McCarthyite efforts are being encouraged by the Biden administration, but students and civil rights groups are fighting back. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, 2 weeks ago, the Anti-Defamation League and the Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law, two right-wing Israel lobby groups masquerading as civil rights organizations, sent notices to hundreds of U.S. universities urging them to punish students who are protesting the Zionist regime's slaughter in Gaza and designate them as terrorists. The two lobby groups demanded that administrations immediately investigate campus chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine for potential violations of the prohibition against materially supporting a foreign terrorist organization. This defamatory and incendiary language was bolstered by the Biden administration's spokesperson, Karine Jean-Pierre, who, on October 30, equated anti-racist activists who protest the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza with violent white supremacists. The The Biden administration released plans to appease the ADL's claims of optics in anti-Jewish bigotry by partnering with law enforcement, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Homeland Security to track hate-related threats and provide federal resources to schools, according to NBC News. An unnamed White House official told NBC that dozens of cybersecurity and protective security experts at DHS have been detailed to engage with the schools as they navigate incredibly tense environments. An associate professor at the City University of New York tweeted recently that faculty were just informed that Muslim students' social media posts about the war are being surveilled by the college and have been reported to the NYPD. Way ahead of the Biden administration, Florida's government had already begun employing such tactics of surveillance and punishment of students in the state. On October 24th, the chancellor of the State University System of Florida released a memorandum directing public universities in Florida to deactivate chapters of National Students for Justice in Palestine on their campuses, stated the civil rights group Palestine Legal. The group added, the memo is filled with erroneous factual and legal claims that seek to distract from, distort, and silence the message of student activists across the United States, the same way Israeli propaganda has sought to distract public attention from ongoing Israeli war crimes. Palestine Legal warned Florida legislators that the call to ban SJP chapters is a flagrant violation of the First Amendment and that it will be challenged in court. The lawyers noted that Florida is attempting to circumvent constitutional rights by claiming that language referring to resistance and the statement that Palestinian students in exile are part of this movement, not in solitary with this movement, somehow makes National Students for Justice in Palestine or the independent student groups that share its name guilty of support for terrorism under the law. This claim on which the ADL and the Brandeis Center are also relying has been used across the U.S. as Islamophobia and anti-Arab bigotry remains unchallenged. Palestine Legal stated, independent protest and organizing in support of Palestinian rights do not constitute material support for terrorism. A coalition of civil rights organizations have urged more than 650 U.S. universities to protect your students from the ongoing campaign to harass, defame, and silence supporters of Palestinian human rights. Palestine Legal and the Center for Constitutional Rights also demanded that the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights address rising Islamophobic and anti-Palestinian attacks. The U.S. Secretary of Education, Miguel Cardona, offered a both-sided approach, saying that he will ask Congress for more funding so that we can make sure we are expediting investigations against anti-Semitism or Islamophobia. The Biden administration is scrambling to hold onto support from Arab and Muslim voters, which has slipped dramatically over Biden's support for the Zionist regime's war crimes. However, universities seem to be heeding the Israel lobby's call to crack down on students' activism in defense of Palestinians. Recently, The Gray Zone reported that David Friedman, the former ambassador to Israel under President Donald Trump, signed a letter to top New York University officials demanding that the university crack down on and even prosecute students who protest Israeli regime's attacks. Brandeis University, meanwhile, revoked its recognition of its Students for Justice in Palestine chapter after students planned to hold a candlelight vigil for the 10,000 Palestinians killed in the Zionist regime's month-long attacks. Using a racist trope that equates support for Palestinians' rights to a call for the deaths of Jews, the university falsely and libelously claimed that National SJP has called on its chapters to engage in conduct that supports Hamas in its call for violent elimination of Israel and the Jewish people. National SJP, for its part, has amplified voices of student activists and called out the mass campaign of lies fueled by Islamophobic and anti-Arab tropes used to generate manufactured consent for the obliteration of an entire people by the Zionist project and the U.S. empire. According to Middle East Monitor, almost two decades after the publication of John Mearsheimer and Stephen Wolff's seminal book, The Israel Lobby and the U.S. Foreign Policy, the influence of the pro-Israel lobby on U.S. politics continues to increase. This influence plays a significant part in shaping Washington's policies and position on the Israel-Palestine issue, preventing Washington from playing an effective mediation role in the region while weakening the U.S. position in the long term. This is true no matter who is in the White House. Lobbying plays a considerable role in U.S. political landscape, policy decisions, and election outcomes. Through substantial campaign contributions, media influence, financial support, and perception management actions, organizations such as AIPAC, JFNA, ADL, and J Street have a big say in America's Israel-related and other policies.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, and other life forms, you're listening to the one, the only youth station.
I'm choo-choo-ka-choo. It's the youth station for you.
Sorry. You're just waiting for
it. I have to throw that in there, yeah. You were waiting for it, though. I could sense it. Yeah.
Anyway, I am your humble host, Zainab, and in the studio with me, I have my brother in faith and humanity and my co-host on the show.
Mudaffar Haider, at your service.
He's okay. I tolerate him. I often compare myself to you.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
I do that as well, actually.
When we're hosting. No, I'm serious.
I compare myself to you as well. It's very difficult to walk in your shadow, sister. You should tone it down a little bit.
My God. Well, you set the bar pretty low for yourself by comparing yourself to me, but I compare myself to you so that I can be on your length wave.
Yeah, I think that's a very natural thing for people to do.
Yeah.
Especially in the media environment, because
exactly.
You're constantly looking at the way that people are presenting. It's all about a show, isn't it?
So it is all about a show.
To an extent, you are always going to be... Yeah, looking at what is being shown by another person so that you can perhaps show the same thing or show better than that.
It or show the entire opposite, you know?
Yeah, or yeah, do something to stay in the limelight, you know?
Exactly. I feel like as human beings, we compare ourselves to others, at least, all the time from the moment we're born, if we have siblings, right? Yeah. Brothers and sisters are all constantly comparing each other. Like my niece, she's 6, and her baby sister is 2, just.
Mashallah, okay.
Right? And though she understands that her baby sister is intelligently inferior to her, and even physically in certain aspects, she's constantly comparing herself to the baby sister and asking, why does the little one get away with certain things?
Oh, that's cute. Yeah, no.
She get more like special attention and stuff like that. And maybe it's a natural thing that we do.
The perfect example of where this kind of behavior starts from. It starts from sibling rivalry. It's why our forefathers, you know, Habil and Qabil, actually, you know, they
killed each other.
Well, one of them killed the other. But yeah, that's where it starts, I guess. And when you compare, there's only two outcomes. Either it's going to be a good outcome or a bad one. So yeah, comparing yourself to others is actually really self-destructive, or it could be, potentially, really self-destructive. Because, okay, naturally you think to yourself you need to have a role model, but then sometimes when you create a role model, it damages you, right? So Islam is teaching us to use our intellect, but we have another faculty, which is the faculty of wahm, which is imagination. Often what happens is whenever we approach accomplishing something for ourselves, like we want to get physically fit, for example, we want to get intelligent, for example, we want to get money, for example, we set ourselves and we create an icon, an idol.
Yeah.
Right? We take somebody who's a celebrity or a sports icon, for example, and what we do is we project our self-image onto them. What we do is we compare ourselves to that image that we've created in our minds. Then what happens? What happens is you try to aspire to that thing that you've created in your mind. It's an idol. It's an imaginary thing that you've just created, right? It's like, I don't know, it's like Arnold Schwarzenegger, but with my face on it, right? Right? And now I'm working out. And you only work out for like 1 day, 2 days. You diet for a day or 3 days, maximum a week. After that, what happens? You give up.
Why?
Because you had created an idol, that image, that icon in your head. I want to aspire to that. And after the 5th day, you looked in the mirror and you were like, I'm nowhere close to that. And it just brought you down. It depressed you. It made you feel like you can't be that good.
Brothers and sisters, we're going to go on a short break, so please stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. You are listening to Youth Station, and we have been talking about comparing ourselves with others. We have a hadith that tell us about how we're meant to compare ourselves to other people. And we, like, even in the case of idolizing and setting role models and exemplars for yourself, even the Quran is constantly telling us, okay, Rasulullah is your uswatun hasana, and Allah is constantly mentioning the stories of past prophets and nations and telling us to take them as...
That's a very good point, yeah.
Like, compare yourselves with them and see whether you're good enough, you're going astray like they are, don't let history repeat itself. So I'm thinking to myself, like every other thing, comparing probably has pros and cons.
Yeah.
We're supposed to compare ourselves to things that we can hold at a realistic standard.
Okay.
One would think that how is holding an infallible, as you know, role model even realistic, yo?
Yeah, really,
or a prophet.
Well, you're supposed to have a really, really, really good role model, because then if you're aspiring to reach 100% and you don't make it that far, then you'll make it to, let's say, 90%.
Shoot for the moon.
Yeah, shoot for the moon. If you miss, you'll land among the stars. Although the stars are further away, so which one is better?
You know, that's a very good point.
It's always confused me, that analogy, right? And like, if you shot for the moon and then you landed on the clouds...
Well, clouds are just dense water. You'd fall through and die.
You would die. So that, I don't know. That analogy was like...
So maybe not shoot for the moon ever?
Don't shoot for the moon. But do aspire to be a better person.
and don't get the moon involved.
Right.
All
right. Okay, if we take an example like who is not an infallible per se, you know, ma'asum, somebody like Salman al-Farsi, you know, Salmanu minna ahlul bayt. He's yeah. from us. Salman is from us, the ahlul bayt, which mm-hmm. meant that he actually transcended to such a great extent. He actually ended up in the family of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. So there's many phases that we have to get
by
through.
Doing what, though?
See, I don't know what you did.
There's a hadith once. It was raining, right? And the ground was a little slushy, muddy, fudgy, right? And Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam had walked out of a house or his house toward the masjid or toward a destination, and he left footprints in the ground. And then Salman followed him, right? As he would, because Salman was always with him. And then Abu Dhar came along, or maybe another sahabi, and looking for Rasulullah, Salman said that, yeah, he's going this way as I am going. And then the sahabi was like, but there's only one set of footprints. And Salman was like, yeah, that's Rasulullah's. I stepped exactly where he stepped. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Salman became Salman because, again, he set the Ahlul Bayt as role models and he followed in their footsteps in every sense of the word, even literally.
Literally.
I'm thinking that, like, oh, there's a hadith. I think Imam Sajjad alayhi salam says that when comparing yourself, comparing your spirituality, compare with yourself with those who are better than you. And when it comes to material things, compare yourselves with those who have less than you.
Subhanallah. Yeah, and that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. True, though. That's an honest answer. I'll give you that. Yeah. Because depending on the situation, you're going to...
The field, yeah. the topic of things. I mean, I'm not going to set...
No, but which out of the Ahlul Bayt stands out to you, or the prophets or imams, you know, which one of them stands out for you as a personal kind of? Because people are attracted to different, for example, out of the 12 imams, you always find this one that you're more attracted to.
Amir al-Mu'mineen.
Okay, all right. So you were to Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yeah, because I don't know, maybe because the history we have about him is the most abundant, rich, a lot.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, partly it's because we have so much more information. We're so much more familiar with that imam.
Exactly. And we don't know that much about all the other imams. That's one. And then I feel that Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, his personality is just so diverse.
It is diverse. It's complex. You
know? Yes, very, very. You can almost relate to him in every field. For a sec, we're going to go for a short break and be right back. When it comes to someone like Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam, we just focus on that climax of his life, which was Ashura. And you can't necessarily always, like, there is, you know, it's relatable to every aspect of life, but we have trouble finding it. When it comes to comparing ourselves with others, I don't know. See, I feel like comparison is such a two-pronged sword. On one hand, I feel like comparison is something is one of the reasons why a lot of youth are struggling with body image. They're struggling with identity. They're struggling with who and what they are in society right now. They're struggling socially, whether it's social media or actual social. But then on the other hand, I feel like at a certain age onward, you sort of have to compare yourself with others in certain matters. That's a lot of certains in one sense. Like when it comes to body image, right? It doesn't matter whether you're skinny or you're fat as long as you're healthy and happy with yourself, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You need to be healthy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not even happy. Healthy first, healthy, then happy.
Healthy is the most... I mean, you'd be happy if you're healthy. Right?
Well, no, some people are like obese.
And they're happy.
They're happy with their lifestyle. It doesn't bother them.
But they're not healthy.
but they're not healthy. Yeah. They're like, yeah. And some people are like super duper skinny, and that's not necessarily healthy either, but they feel like, oh, I'm a supermodel. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe like comparing, I don't know the psychological logic behind it, but I think, okay, while we're teens, we shouldn't compare till a certain age.
It's impossible, isn't it? Which teenager doesn't compare themselves to the popular girl in the class or to some celebrity?
And then, yeah, exactly. It's really hard to say. But then during that age that we do it the most, we shouldn't be doing it the most. You know what I'm trying
to say? Yeah, because you're most sensitive at that age, right?
Yeah.
I remember being really, like, vulnerable.
Vulnerable,
yeah. Yeah, you're really vulnerable. It's a horrible world when you're a teenager.
It is a horrible world.
Yeah.
It's both a wonderful world and a horrible world. It's wonderful because you're still so wide-eyed and innocent.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're getting doses of reality here and there, and it's just like hitting you like a bus.
Right, yeah. You do need a comparison, though, because, okay, who is your... Okay, now this is an easier question.
What?
Who was your role model when you were a teenager in that vulnerable phase of life where you're looking for...
I don't know, some pop star. All right, so that's basically all the time we have for today. But just to wrap it up, we'd have to say that when it comes to spirituality, like the Ahlul Bayt said, compare ourselves with those who are higher. When it comes to material things, compare ourselves with those who have less. So it gives us perspective and it creates a balance.
Right.
And also we have yet to discuss whether or not comparing ourselves to others is actually fundamentally a good thing at all.
Mm.
Right? That and much more in future episodes of Youth Station. Until then, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, the light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
No end in sight to the deadly Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. The regime pounds civilian targets, including schools and hospitals. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement launches retaliatory strikes from southern Lebanon against Israeli forces amid escalating tensions in the border areas. And worldwide rallies are held around the globe.